Here we are to think about near-death experiences and do these provide a case for the afterlife? And the reason why we are able to discuss such a phenomenon today is because since the 1960s in the clinical setting, we've been able to resuscitate patients. And so patients, for example, in cardiac arrest can be resuscitated, and also some in situations of needing neurosurgery were needing to be put in a state of reversible clinical death. So a few different scenarios now in medicine where patients have been resuscitated from being clinically dead. And a significant number have begun to report that even though their body was dead and they were seemingly unconscious, they were actually vividly conscious and able to report in ways that were verifiable. So we're going to unpack this area, or begin to unpack it. Obviously, we're not going to be able to cover everything. But do NDEs present a challenge to the materialist view that says that we are just our brains? I want to start by telling you a story, which happened in 1943. And the quote is, Pim van Lommel, who's a cardiologist, and he writes about this later in one of his books. But the person it happened to was called George Ritchie, and he wrote about his experience in a book called Return from Tomorrow. It happened in 1943. He was a medical student. He had a double pneumonia, and antibiotics were less prevalent in 1943, and he ended up having a cardiac arrest. And it says, and Van Lommel's account of it, following an episode of very high fever and extreme tightness of the chest, he passed away. He ceased breathing and his pulse also stopped. He was pronounced dead by a doctor and covered with a sheet. But a male nurse was so upset by the death of his medical student that he managed to persuade the attendant doctor to administer an adrenaline injection in the chest near the heart. A most unusual procedure in those days. Having been dead for more than 9 minutes, George Ritchie regained consciousness. To the immense surprise of the doctor and nurse, it emerged that during his spell of unconsciousness, the period in which he'd been pronounced dead, he had had an extremely powerful experience of which he could recollect a great many details. And Ritchie wrote a book about his experiences called Return from Tomorrow, and he wrote about what happened to him in those 9 minutes. And this is one of the earliest accounts, really, of what then became known as the near-death experience. It was Raymond Moody who came up with that phrase. And actually, so after Ritchie qualified as a psychiatrist, he began to share his experience with his medical students. And one of those was Raymond Moody, who became fascinated with the whole area and began to sort of systematically investigate this phenomenon, which he coined near-death experiences. And he conducted 150 interviews of patients and wrote a book that was first published in 1975, sold 14 million copies, and the latest version has actually three forewords from three different people, and it's still selling well. And so in terms of the history of near-death experiences, there's like a first generation of NDE researchers in the 80s and 90s that included people like Dr. Kenneth Ring, who was at the University of Connecticut. He established the Journal of Near-Death Studies. And then there was Bruce Grayson, a psychiatrist in Virginia, who did the first systematic American study. And then there were some British psychiatrists, Dr. Peter Fenwick and Dr. Sam Parnia, and they conducted the first British study on 63 cardiac arrest survivors at Southampton General Hospital. And what we see is professionals by the early 1970s came to see death not as an instantaneous event, but as a gradual process, one that could sometimes be interrupted and reversed. During close brushes with death, people were reporting experiences of what for most of them was another reality, experiences that were occurring at the very time they were closest to or actually in the first moments of death. And that comes from a handbook of near-death experience. So the first thing to say is that this is not just an anecdotal area anymore. We have actually 50 years of systematic research and documentation. It's beyond the kind of realm of anecdotes. A number of cardiologists and psychiatrists and that have nothing necessarily to gain from it became fascinated and began to study it in detail. I've mentioned already the Journal of Near-Death Studies. Then there's the Handbook of Near-Death Experiences, which is a summary of that first 30 years of research, where there were 42 different studies of over 2,500 patients who'd had an NDE and that were published in scientific journals. They've all been summarized in this Handbook of Near-Death Experiences. A Gallup poll in 1982 in the US said about 5% of the US population have had one of these. And then there are numerous other people that have looked into it. One such person is Pim van Lommel, who's a Dutch cardiologist, and he summarized his findings in his book, Consciousness Beyond Life. And he, after reading Ritchie's story in 1986, began to systematically investigate. And he looked at over 300 heart attack survivors. And so the figures are pretty high. The first British study of 63 patients said about 11% had had an NDE. The first American study of 116 patients, about 15% had had an NDE. And there have been other studies around the world. So this is all to say, this is beyond anecdote. Of course, this is not a new phenomenon. In the religious realm, people have been talking about death for a long time. And there are examples of NDEs in most holy books, the Bible, Plato's Dialogues, the Egyptian Book of the Dead, and the Tibetan Book of the Dead. There was actually a guy reading the Tibetan Book of the Dead on the plane that I was on the way over here. I thought that was interesting plane reading. And according to one author, 95% of the world's cultures report NDEs. And Grayson in the Handbook of NDEs puts that accounts of near-death and out-of-body experiences can be found in the oral traditions and written literature of about 95% of the world's cultures. So, but what we're the kind of season that we're in now is that we're seeing in the scientific and clinical realm a phenomenon that people have been talking about religiously for many centuries. Does that give it a new credibility? And that's actually one thing we'll talk about later. What's interesting is that although, you know, there are variations in how people express their NDE, and people of different religious beliefs might have slightly different emphases, there are a number of common features that seem to come up again and again. And so van Lommel lists 12 elements to an NDE based on the experiences of his patients, and these are approximately in the order that they occur. I'm just going to go through these quickly so I don't take up too much time in speaking, but one of them is ineffability. There's an otherworldliness to the experience that's hard to put into words. For example, words like an immense, intense, pure love compared to which our human dimension pales into insignificance. There's also the disappearance of fear of death in with that ineffability. NDEers seem to lose a fear of death. They experience love and acceptance rather than condemnation and uncertainty. Secondly, a feeling of peace and quiet. The pain is gone, whatever pain they were experiencing. For example, following an accident, that is instantly gone in the NDE. Thirdly, they have an awareness of being dead. In fact, they often hear the doctors declare that the person is dead, even though they feel very much alive. Fourthly, there's often an out-of-body experience. Patients perceive their situation from a position outside of their body, all whilst retaining a clear sense of personal identity and consciousness. And many patients make observations from this out-of-body position that are verified. There are instances such as, I mean, you probably heard of the tennis shoe on the roof, that one patient reported that they could actually go to that location and find the shoe. Other instances in a book by Gary Habermas and J.P. Moreland called Beyond Death talks about somebody who traveled down the hospital and heard a conversation in another part of the hospital by their family members about them and was able to recount the details of this later on. Instantly, it wasn't a very good conversation, so that was awkward. It's like, I'm still alive, actually. And
we should be careful what we say.
Give it 15 minutes.
So the thing that's interesting is there are factors that have been verifiable as well. There are also elements that the person escapes the physical limits of their body. So there are reports of someone that is congenitally blind in life, in their NDE, was able to vividly see everything and describe the room, or someone that was deaf throughout their life, during their NDE, they could hear everything perfectly. So something about not being limited by their physicality anymore. Fifthly, a dark space. Some people are brought abruptly into an enclosed space or a void. 15% of people experience their stay in this dark space as frightening. There are some accounts of very disturbing NDEs. They're a lower proportion, but they do exist. Some people experience a tunnel experience and have been drawn towards a light, but the tunnel itself is dark, so it's a dark space. And some people, 1-2%, are trapped. They feel trapped in this dark space and unable to escape until the end of the NDE. Number six, their perception of an unearthly environment, which is similar to the first point, I guess, that it's otherworldly. So one quote, "What I saw was too beautiful for words. I was looking at a magnificent landscape full of flowers and plants that I couldn't actually name. They all looked hundreds of miles away, and yet I could see everything in detail, even without glasses, although in real life I have bad eyesight. It was both far away and close, exceptionally beautiful. The best way to describe it would be a heavenly sight." Seventh, the ability to meet and communicate with deceased friends and relatives. People report meeting people that they knew in life and didn't know had died, actually, and could not have known. So, for example, in multiple traffic accidents involving whole families, a person would actually, when they're resuscitated, say, "Oh, I met that other person," and they hadn't been told at that point that that family member had died, but they had already met them in their NDE. So really fascinating details like this, meeting and communicating with deceased friends and relatives. And then eighth, the perception of a brilliant light or a being of light. And this is often where a person's religious background might influence how they name this being. Some do name that being as Jesus, others an angel or another kind of a part of their religious beliefs. Number nine, a lot of people have a panoramic life review. Usually this is experienced in the presence of the being of light. They say they see their whole life pass before their eyes. One quote, "People experience not just their very action or word, but also every thought from their past life. And they realize that everything is an energy that affects both themselves and others." How on earth you experience every thought from your past life, I don't know. But again, it's pointing to the kind of otherworldliness of this experience. Number 10, a preview or a flash forward, the ability to see part of the life that is to come. That often relates to people being returned to their body with a sense of purpose. Number 11, perception of a border, that if they cross it, it's the point of no return. Yes. And then number 12, conscious return to the body. Some patients learn through wordless communication, through this being of light, that they ought to return to life, especially if they have something to do. This often is carried out reluctantly. Many people don't want to. They prefer being where they are. They don't actually want to return to the body, and they describe themselves as being pulled back into their body. It's often an unpleasant experience, and of course the pain immediately returns once they are in the body. And then finally, there's a transformational effect. Many go on to show greater compassion, greater importance and relationships after their NDE. So a number of, so when we're responding to this apologetically, people might say, you know, it's kind of varies so much, how can they be relied upon? But there are actually a number of well-documented common threads that we seem to see throughout the majority of NDEs that give it a certain amount of grounding. So why are NDEs so interesting apologetically? Do they provide evidence that human consciousness continues even after the death of the body and brain? And if so, what do we make of the view that, as Max already saying, that conscious states are merely brain states, that consciousness is no more than brain chemistry, which is voiced by a number of scientists and philosophers. We could look at many people, but one is Francis Crick, who in The Astonishing Hypothesis said that you, your joys and your sorrows, your memories and your ambitions, your sense of personal identity and free will are in fact no more than the behavior of a vast assembly of nerve cells and their associated molecules. As Lewis Carroll might have phrased it, you're nothing but a pack of neurons. And if it's true that we are just packs of neurons, then when the brain dies, that ought to be the end of human consciousness. But NDEs present a challenge to this view. They also present a challenge in the light of some emergentist approaches to human consciousness. Another view is that the brain generates conscious states. And that the mind is derivative from the physical brain, even though it can't be reduced back to physics and chemistry. But even with that view, this still presents a challenge. Even if you have the word emergent or generate in there, you still are tied to physical things. So if the brain dies, then there ought not to be consciousness. Of course, some Christians who hold this view believe that there's more going on than just that, that it's your relationship with God that enables your continued existence. And so that's why some Christians hold to this view and don't see this as being a problem. What I would like to do for the last few minutes is just talk about some of the objections that people raise to NDEs. So some would say that NDEs are anomalies, they're these occasional things that you see, but hopefully I've shown that they're not anomalies. They seem to be very prevalent across different nations, different beliefs, different types of patient, different backgrounds, that they've gone beyond being anomalous. And of course, if materialism is true, there should be no cases, not just one or two. They are impossible. Some people say NDEs are occurring because of fragments of consciousness lingering in the brain. Of course, what do they mean by fragments of consciousness? And lingering, exactly. And that presumes that consciousness is physical. But of course, this fragmented experience would be very different to what we seem to be reading, which is of something that's very vivid and coherent. So fragmentation of whatever it is doesn't seem to fit. Perhaps one of the more prevalent objections, NDEs are caused by oxygen deprivation to the brain, and that produces hallucinations. That oxygen deprivation can produce hallucinations with tunnel vision. But actually, if you take Van Lommel's study, all 344 his patients were clinically dead. And so if anoxia is the cause, they should all have had an NDE because they are all in a state of anoxia. But not everyone did, only 18%. And people that have experienced hallucinations and NDEs say that they're two very different things. And generally, you need a functioning brain to hallucinate. But the data, the patients that we're looking at are clinically dead. There is no detectable EEG signal. The other thing we say about hallucinations is that you really, the images when you hallucinate are related to images that you have already encountered in life. But these kinds of things seem to be very otherworldly. So the argument for hallucination doesn't seem to stack up either. Fourthly, some people say these are just being induced by the drugs that a patient is being given at that point, or hypogravity or electrical stimulation. But Van Lommel reports that there are, you know, experiences that people gain when they are given drugs of different types, but they're very different to what an NDE recoverer reports. They don't seem to have a life review. They are much more fragmented, and there are no transformational effects. And also, we need to say that NDEs, again, we keep coming back to the fact that they're occurring in a state of clinical death, that they're actually dead. So the effect of a drug on their brain is irrelevant. Another response, oh no, it's back here, that NDE has embellished their story over time, but they've got this, they kind of, well, maybe it's an extension of fabricating it, and it gets more and more elaborate over time. But Van Lommel was careful to interview patients within 7 days of resuscitation so that he can capture, you know, keep that as short as possible in order to hopefully gain an accurate sense of what really happened. Another view raised by Susan Blackmore is that the life changes that occur from NDEs are not from having died, but just from facing up to the fact of death. And she says this, that the limited evidence available suggests that this change is a function of simply facing up to death, not of having a near-death experience. But when NDEers behave altruistically, this helps spread their NDE memes. I'm a nice person. I'm not so selfish now. Believe me, I really did go to heaven. Wanting to agree with this honestly nice person helps spread the memes. And if the NDE survivor really does help you, you may take on the NDE memes as a way of returning the kindness. Thus, NDE memes spread, and among them is the idea that people who have had NDEs behave much more altruistically. So the altruism shown by survivors of NDEs helps to spread the NDE meme, meaning that people are nicer to each other. But again, Van Lommel and others say, look, people that face up to death doesn't induce the kind of life changes that we're seeing from NDE people, NDE patients. Otherwise, if that was true, then all heart attack survivors would change their lives because they've all had to face up to death. But that doesn't happen. There seems to be something qualitatively different about NDE patients. And of course, the concept of memes, units of thought that can replicate, is more hypothetical and untestable. By contrast, clinical death is verifiable and testable, and NDEs are testable. Another view that there's an evolutionary approach here, that you're not actually dead, you're in a deep state of unconsciousness in order to survive whatever danger you're facing and kind of troubleshoot in order to work out strategies to escape. A bit like in the animal world, when someone is in the presence of a predator, like an opossum is known for like suddenly going unconscious in order to kind of survive. They basically are playing dead, I guess, ultimately. But of course, to that, we would say that the person with the NDE is not feigning death. They are actually dead. And therefore, they're not in a position to troubleshoot anything. And again, the people that have had an NDE, they're often disappointed to return. They don't want to come back. And they do not have a survival strategy. They'd rather stay where they are. And then finally, perhaps in some ways, perhaps the most powerful objection of all, that NDE counts are easily fabricated. And of course, there is a story of a boy that, I don't have details of it here, but he fabricated his story. He wrote, a book was written and it sold millions of copies and he toured the world talking about it. And then he essentially owned up a few years later that he had made it all up. And we, you know, that is entirely possible. And so we need to acknowledge that there are some that could be fabricated. But if we look at the body of the data as a whole, there does seem to be something a bit more than beyond all of it being fabricated. And the way to, in a sense, safeguard against that is to look at accounts from people who have very little to gain from their experience or nothing to gain from it. And one such person that I find persuasive is Eben Alexander, who is a former Harvard neurosurgeon, and he was a strict physicalist as a neurosurgeon. His patients would come to him and say, I've had an NDE, and he'd say, don't be ridiculous. If you don't have a functioning cortex, you can't be conscious. And he would dismiss their reports until he himself developed severe bacterial meningitis at the age of 54, went into a coma. His entire cortex had shut down, all the areas of the brain known to be associated with human consciousness. He wasn't expected to survive, but he actually did. He was in this coma 7 days. And when he recovered, he described an extremely vivid NDE, which changed his view. I mean, he's not a Christian, but he now believes that my experience showed me that the death of the body and the brain are not the end of consciousness, that human experience continues beyond the grave. And he believes that in a context where all of his former colleagues are strict physicalists. Like, why would you change your view unless you were convinced that something real had happened to you? So look to the examples from people who have nothing to gain by advocating for such a phenomenon of NDEs.